The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you so much for being here this evening. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I'm excited, and I thought I could do maybe a short reading, but I don't want this to be a monologue, you know, just only me speaking, only me reading, so I would be very happy if you could share your thoughts, your opinion with me, your comments. So please feel free to ask me questions, and then we can turn this into a dialogue. The 40 Rules of Love came out in Turkey first, although it was written in English first. So this could be one of the things we can talk about later, if you'd be interested. For the last 6 years, I've been writing fiction in both English and Turkish. So The Saint of Incipient Insanities, The Bastard of Istanbul, and this book, The 40 Rules of Love, have been written in English first. What we did with The 40 Rules of Love was, after I finished the English version, it was translated into Turkish by a very good translator, but I took that translation and in a way I rewrote it. And with the energy that came to me after finishing it, I came back to the English version and in a way I rewrote it. So it was a crazy amount of work, but I love language. I love playing with language. We can also talk about this. So in a way, this book was written twice, you know, in two parallel languages. And that was a very interesting experience for me to commute back and forth between English and Turkish. As a matter of fact, that those parallel worlds also exist within the book, because this is a book within a book. It's a story within a story. Perhaps I can say it's a love within a love story. On the one hand, we have the love between Ella, my Jewish American housewife character, who lives in Boston, and Aziz, who is a modern-day Sufi living in Amsterdam. So as she keeps reading his book, his novel, in a way she falls in love with him, and she gets to learn more about Rumi. The book talks a lot about Rumi, about 13th century Anatolia. And I thought this could be one of the things we can talk about tonight, Sufism, Rumi, Rumi's philosophy, how it touches, you know, to our hearts, even after almost 800 years. I travel a lot, and it always fascinates me to see people who cannot find the place of Konya on the map. Konya is the town where Rumi lived. They don't know where Konya is. They don't know perhaps where Anatolia is. But when you say Rumi, it means something to them. Actually, it means a lot to them. So where does that charm come from? I didn't want to present Rumi in a theoretical, you know, abstract, solid framework. I wanted to understand how that charm works, you know, how his words reach out through centuries, through continents, through cultures. That's why I was interested in how that spiritual love that Rumi is talking about touches our hearts and transforms our mundane worldly loves today. That's why in the book within the book, I have the love story, the spiritual love story between Rumi and his companion, Shams of Tabriz. It fascinates me to see how different they were, and yet at the same time how deeply they transformed each other. They met in Konya. Rumi was very, in my opinion, a very generous person, very, you know, I think in my opinion, he's like water. He's very flexible, very fluid in many ways. Whereas Shams was fire. So in my eyes, this is the love between fire and water. They changed each other a lot. And this is one of the central themes in the book, because I think when we start to love someone, we change a lot. So love is about transformation. All throughout the book, there are 40 rules of love. These are the rules that I formulated, but nevertheless, as I was writing these rules, I was deeply inspired by Sufi philosophy in general and Rumi's views or Shams's views in particular. Now, with your permission, if you will bear with me, I'm going to do I'm going to read two sections. The first section is about Ella, the modern housewife that I just mentioned. It's from the very, very beginning of the book. Between your fingers, you hold a stone and throw it into flowing water. The effect might not be easy to see. There will be a small ripple where the stone breaks the surface, and then a splash muffled by the rush of the surrounding river. That's all. Throw a stone into a lake. The effect will be not only visible, but also far more lasting. The stone will disrupt the still waters. A circle will form where the stone hit the water, and in a flash, that circle will multiply into another, then another. Before long, the ripples caused by one plop will expand until they can be felt everywhere along the mirrored surface of the water. Only when the circles reach the shore will they stop and die out. If a stone hits a river, the river will treat it as yet another commotion in its already tumultuous course. Nothing unusual, nothing unmanageable. If a stone hits a lake, however, the lake will never be the same again. For 40 years, Ella Rubinstein's life had consisted of still waters, a predictable sequence of habits, needs, and preferences. Though it was monotonous and ordinary in many ways, she had not found it tiresome. During the last 20 years, every wish she had, every person she befriended, and every decision she made was filtered through her marriage. Her husband David was a successful dentist who worked hard and made a lot of money. She had always known that they did not connect on any deep level, but connecting emotionally need not be a priority on a married couple's list, she thought, especially for a man and a woman who had been married for so long. There were more important things than passion and love in a marriage, such as understanding, affection, compassion, and that most godlike act a person could perform, forgiveness. Love was secondary to any of these. Unless, that is, one lived in novels or romantic movies where the protagonists were always larger than life and their love nothing short of legend. Ella's children topped her list of priorities. They had a beautiful daughter in college, Jeanette, and teenage twins, Orly and Avi. Also, they had a 12-year-old golden retriever, Spirit, who had been Ella's walking buddy in the mornings and her cheeriest companion ever since he had been a puppy. Now he was old, overweight, completely deaf, and almost blind. Spirit's time was coming, but Ella preferred to think he would go on forever. Then again, that was how she was. She never confronted the death of anything, be it a habit, a phase, or a marriage, even when the end stood right in front of her, plain and inevitable. The Rubinsteins lived in Northampton, Massachusetts, in a large Victorian house that needed some renovation but still was splendid, with 5 bedrooms, 3 baths, shiny hardwood floors, a 3-car garage, French doors, and best of all, an outdoor jacuzzi. They had life insurance, car insurance, retirement plans, college saving plans, joint bank accounts, and in addition to the house they lived in, 2 prestigious apartments, one in Boston, the other in Rhode Island. She and David had worked hard for all this, a big, busy house with children, elegant furniture, and the scent of homemade pies might seem a cliché to some people, but to them it was the picture of an ideal life. They had built their marriage around this shared vision and had attained most, if not all, of their dreams. On their last Valentine's Day, her husband had given her a heart-shaped diamond pendant and a card that read, "To my dear Ella, a woman with a quiet manner, a generous heart, and the patience of a saint. Thank you for accepting me as I am. Thank you for being my wife. Yours, David." Ella had never confessed this to her husband, but reading his card had felt like reading an obituary. "This is what they will write about me when I die," she had thought, and if they were sincere, they might also add this. Building her whole life around her husband and children, Ella lacked any survival techniques to help her cope with life's hardships on her own. She was not the type to throw caution to the wind. Even changing her daily coffee brand was a major effort. All of which is why no one, including Ella, could explain what was going on when she filed for divorce in the fall of 2008 after 20 years of marriage. But there was a reason, love. They did not live in the same city, not even on the same continent. The two of them were not only miles apart, but also as different as day and night. Their lifestyles were so dissimilar that it seemed impossible for them to bear each other's presence, never mind fall in love. But it happened, and it happened fast. So fast, in fact, that Ella had no time to realize what was happening and to be on guard, if one could ever be on guard against love. Love came to Ella as suddenly and abruptly as if a stone had been hurled from out of nowhere into the tranquil pond of her life. So this is the very beginning of the book. I must say, the book came out, the novel came out, as I said, in Turkey first. It had a different title then. I used the word aşk, love. In Turkey, we have two different words for love. And the word, so there are two different ways of saying I love you. As we were publishing the English version, I wanted to use a different title. I wanted to make it the 40 Rules of Love. The rules might sound a little bit strict, but this is something Rumi himself uses. He talks about the religion of love. He talks about the rules of love. And it always amazed me, intrigued me to hear that, because we associate love with a more chaotic thing, you know, as if it's quite unpredictable, and rules are more strict. So how can a 13th century philosopher, how can a 13th century poet bring these two together? It was a big question mark for me as I was writing. So I wanted to make the title out of that question mark. But I must say, all the characters in this book are ultimately, although there are historical characters, they're ultimately my imagination. Someone else might have a very different depiction of Shems of Tebriz. Someone else might have a quite different one. And I think that's good. So I can never say that I understood, you know, Rumi fully, or I understood Shems of Tebriz fully. And it is, you know, I grasp the absolute truth. I don't think there's such a thing, because we always bring our gaze. When we read something, when we write something, we always bring our personal perspective into it. So what you will find in this book is my personal perspective. And sometimes I liken my books to houses, to buildings with multiple doors, multiple corridors. I like the fact that each and every reader enters into that house, spends time in different rooms, and sometimes two readers who might be very good friends in daily life, they spend time in that building without bumping into each other. They feel close to different characters. They get a different feeling from the same book, and then they exit through different doors. That's what I like about fiction. I think fiction is so fluid, it's so flexible, and it's so open to interpretation that the reader herself or himself is also in the story. Not only the writer, but the reader as well is actively constructing the story. Now, I'm going to read a second part. This is from Rumi's, from the historical part, the book within the book. And this takes place in 1245 in Konya, Anatolia. Beautiful is your life, full and complete. Or so you think, until someone comes along and makes you realize what you have been missing all this time. Like a mirror that reflects what is absent rather than present, he shows you the void in your soul, the void you have resisted seeing. That person can be a lover, a friend, or a spiritual master. Sometimes it can be a child to look after. What matters is to find the soul that will complete yours. All the prophets have given the same advice. Find the one who will be your mirror. For me, that mirror is Shems of Tebriz. Until he came and forced me to look deep into the crannies of my soul, I had not faced the fundamental truth about myself, that though successful and prosperous inside, I was lonely and unfulfilled inside. It is as if for years on end you compile a personal dictionary. In it, you give your definition of every concept that matters to you, such as truth, happiness, or beauty. At every major turning point in life, you refer to this personal dictionary, hardly ever feeling the need to question its premises. Then one day, a stranger comes and snatches your precious dictionary and throws it away. All your definitions need to be redefined, he says. It is time for you to unlearn everything you know. And you, for some reason unbeknownst to your mind but obvious to your heart, instead of raising objections or getting cross with him, you gladly comply. This is what Shems has done to me. Our friendship has taught me so much. But more than that, he has taught me to unlearn everything I knew. When you love someone this much, you expect everyone around you to feel the same way, sharing your joy. And when that doesn't happen, you feel surprised, then offended and betrayed. How could I possibly make my family and friends see what I see? How could I describe the indescribable? Shems is my sea of mercy and grace. He is my son of truth and faith. I call him the King of Kings of Spirit. He is my fountain of life and my tall cypress tree, majestic and evergreen. His companionship is like the fourth reading of the Quran, a journey that can only be experienced from within but never grasped from the outside. Unfortunately, most people make their evaluations based on images and hearsay. To them, Shems is an eccentric dervish. They think he behaves strangely and speaks blasphemy, that he is utterly unpredictable and unreliable. To me, however, he is love that moves the whole universe. At times retreating into the background and holding every piece together, at times exploding in bursts. An encounter of this kind happens once in a lifetime, once in 38 years. Ever since Shems came into our lives, people have been asking me what it is in him that I find so special. But there's no way I can answer them. At the end of the day, those who ask this question are the ones who won't understand it. And as for those who do understand, they don't ask such things. The quandary I find myself in reminds me of the story of Layla and Harun al-Rashid, the famous Abbasid emperor. Upon hearing that a Bedouin poet named Qais had fallen hopelessly in love with Layla and lost his mind for her and was therefore named Majnun, the madman, the emperor became very curious about the woman who had caused such misery. This Layla must be a very special creature, he thought, a woman far superior to all other women. Perhaps she's an enchantress, unequaled in beauty and charm. I must see her. Excited, intrigued, he played every trick in the book to find a way to see Layla with his own eyes. Finally, one day, they brought Layla to the emperor's palace. When she took off her veil, Harun al-Rashid was disillusioned. Not that Layla was ugly, crippled, or old, but she wasn't extraordinarily attractive either. She was a human being with ordinary human needs and several flaws, a simple woman like countless others. The emperor did not hide his disappointment. Are you the one Majnun has been crazy about? Why, you look so ordinary. What is so special about you? Layla broke into a smile. Yes, I am Layla, she said, but you're not Majnun, you see. You have to see me with the eyes of Majnun. Otherwise, you could never solve this mystery called love. How can I explain the same mystery to my family, friends, or students? How can I make them understand that for them to grasp what is so special about Shems of Tabriz, they have to start looking at him with the eyes of Majnun? So these were the words of Rumi in the book. If you'd like, I'll stop here, the reading. I would love to hear your thoughts, your questions. Please feel free to share them with me. I look forward to hearing your voice.
I have not read your latest book, the one that you wrote before, but Ambassador to Istanbul, he's an Armenian who reconnects. Oh, please, do I have to? An Armenian that reconnects or tries to reconnect with what went on. What did it take for you to reconnect as someone that grew up in a very, not that Turkey is not European, but someone who grew up in the Alsace and then in Spain and went back to Turkey and is now one of their foremost writers?
Thank you. I appreciate the question. I like the word you used, connect. I think it's very important to me because I think most art and literature is about connections. you know, building connections. First, we learn how to connect with the voices inside. For me, writing fiction is an inner journey. And I think each and every one of us, we have so many multiple voices inside us. Perhaps the voices that speak, you know, in the public space are only some of those voices that exist inside. So when we produce art, when we produce literature, we connect to all the voices within. Also, literature, writing fiction, for me, is connecting to other people. And when I say this, across the boundaries, this could be national boundaries, religious boundaries, you know, gender boundaries. I think there's something similar between Sufism and art or literature, in the sense that in both there's a desire to surpass the limits of the self that has been given to us by birth. For me, writing fiction is not talking about myself, you know, writing my story, telling my personal story to other people. I'm not that interested in myself, to be frank, you know. I'm interested in other people's stories. I'm interested in being, you know, the other, looking at one thing from another perspective, and then another perspective, and then someone else's perspective, to the point that there's no other anymore. I think for a writer, for an artist, there should be no other, and I cannot otherize anyone. And so I very much believe in those connections. In another sense, I also think, maybe this is going to sound a little bit mystical, but when we're writing, we also connect with the universe. You know, all the words we bring out, all the stories we bring out, every human being, we're a little microcosmos. We reflect the universe inside. So when we are producing stories, because stories belong to all of us, they have no owners, they travel the world, and they have been traveling the world for centuries, again, we connect with the universe at large. So in my books, there's a lot of that, you know, connections. I bring people together, I mean, people from very different backgrounds. Not all of my books have been translated into English, but hopefully, you know, as time goes by, as the new books or the older books come out, perhaps then you will agree with me. In almost all of my books, you see these very different characters, I mean, different characters with very different backgrounds coming together and creating common energy. In one book, this could be an Armenian, you know, character with a Turkish character, how they come together and create a common energy. In another book, it might be, you know, Shems and Rumi, fire and water coming together. But I very much believe in cosmopolitan culture. I think in this world, if we're going to learn anything, we're not going to learn it from people who are exactly like us, who think exactly like us, right, who talk exactly like us. We're going to learn it from people who are different than us. That's why we need to get together with different people, you know, with the stranger, with the foreigner. So I very much believe in that synergy, in that mixture, the synthesis of seeming opposites coming together. And in all my books, I think those connections are very, very vital. Thank you.
I absolutely loved your book. And speaking about connections, when I was reading the book and I got to the parts that were in the 1245 year, I felt as though it was very much, I got lost thinking that it was in the present. So that many of the experiences and the people and the feelings were just like today. So that was a definite connection, that people are people, the thoughts are the thoughts, love is love.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate what you said. And I think I very much believe in what you said. On the one hand, Rumi's century looks so different. You know, it's the pre-modern era. It's so very different than the age we're living. But at the same time, it is so similar. And it fascinates me. I mean, it was a very turbulent time in Anatolia, you know. When you look at the life they have been living, there was a lot of ambiguity. You know, and a lot of fear in the air, and the clash of cultures, the clash of different religions, different sects. So all of that was there. But in the middle of that chaos, in the middle of all that turbulence, political, social, economic turbulence, there's this philosopher, there's this poet talking about love, talking about the religion of love, surpassing all religious, you know, divisions and quarrels. So if he could do it at such a time, we can do it today, right? In that sense as well, I think it's good to see the similarities. I appreciate what you said.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My question is driven by your graduate degrees. My impression is that women in Turkey have benefited from the westernization of Turkey, and yet their role is being threatened by the growing strength of the Islamic forces within the Turkish society. A, is my impression correct? And B, how do you see this conflict growing between the two forces impacting women in particular evolving over the next several years?
Thank you. It is such an important question. It's a big question, though. I think it has many, many layers. But I'll try to share with you, you know, how I feel, how I see. I think Turkey is a very interesting country. It is a very complicated country. And it doesn't very easily fit into any category. It is the most westernized, if I may say that, country. When you look at the Muslim world, it is very unique in many ways. It is a country in which the secularization, modernization, westernization processes started pretty early, and they have been carried not only into the public space, but also the private space. And by the private space, I mean the space, the domain of women, like the family structure. In many traditional or Eastern or Muslim countries, we usually see westernization means adopting technology, but not, you know, changing the culture. That's not what happened in Turkey. The culture was also kept moving ahead, moving forward. So it's not only the public space that has been reshaped, but the private space. And I think this is a very interesting thing about Turkey. And women have entered into the public space at a relatively speaking very early period, in 1920s, 1930s. Today, depending on which area you concentrate, you might get a different picture. Like, if we're looking at academia, university, the percentage of women academics is amazingly high, and in some places it's higher than European countries. If you look at media, again, written media or TV, again, the percentage of women is amazing. Or in literature or in art. So there are certain domains where women are really very visible, they're very vocal. However, if you look at politics, this time the percentage of women is very, very low. Unfortunately, it's very low. So politics is still a men-dominated area, and it's always either in opposition or in power, it's always men that, you know, make the final decision. So in that respect, we have a long way to go. I think Turkey is a country in which women have taken huge steps forward, but at the same time, it is a country in which honor killings also happen. So we should see the positive and the negative, the good and the bad at the same time. I do not see an Islamic threat, you know, against Turkish women. And, you know, these are, of course, big, big discussions, but I think the secular culture in Turkey is deeply rooted, and it is deeply, deeply internalized. But what intrigues me is when I talk about patriarchy, for me, patriarchy is not a system in which, first of all, it is universal. You know, it's not, in my opinion, patriarchy exists in many, many countries, although in different degrees. And patriarchy, for me, is not a system in which men oppress women. You know, it's black and white. I think women also contribute, unfortunately, in oppressing each other, sometimes knowingly, sometimes unknowingly. We compete a lot. Sometimes in traditional settings, as women get older, when they have sons, when they become mothers, when they become mother-in-laws, they also can use their power against younger women who do not have children yet. So it's much more complicated than, you know, this party doing something, you know, exerting oppression or men oppressing women. I think there are many, many more layers that help patriarchy to reproduce itself, and we women are also responsible for that because we internalize those patriarchal values.
Okay. Hello, my name is Joshkun. I picked your book for my flight reading from Istanbul to Turkey. And I must say, it is one of the best novels I have ever read.
Okay.
And it was such a great book, I couldn't drop during my flight. And when I arrived home, There was still a few chapters left, and I was tired. And the next morning when I woke up, I finished reading the entire book. My question to you, can you talk about language while you are writing your novel? Did you feel any place you can express in one language than other, like, this was great in Turkish, but I couldn't say in English. Like, can you talk about those places?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, language has been my passion ever since I was a child. I think each and every one of us, our memories, you know, we have, it's not, I mean, we use only one word for memory, but maybe we should have more words than that. Some of us have a very good visual memory. When we see, you know, someone, we never forget his face. Some of us have very good mathematical memory. We're very good with numbers, right? So each and every one of us uses our memories in different ways. With me, I have a good memory with words, right? I like words. And to me, it's like a mystery, like magic. By changing the place of letters to obtain endless meanings, you know, to keep changing meanings. I love doing that since I was a child. So before separating it into Turkish or English, I should say words, letters, it's a big mystery to me still. Now, that said, I love writing in Turkish. So writing in English is not something I have chosen to substitute that. I think it is perfectly possible in this age to be bilingual or multilingual or multicultural. This is perhaps a little bit unusual in the Turkish literary scene today. I mean, writing English fiction in English and in Turkish. But it's not unusual when we look at the world. Around the world, there have been writers writing in two languages or three languages. And it's perfectly possible. As a matter of fact, I think this is the age in which it's even more possible than before. Because this is the age of movements, migrations, right? We're constantly moving. We're constantly speaking in more than one language. As a matter of fact, we're dreaming in more than one language. In our dreams, sometimes we dream in Turkish, sometimes in Spanish, you know, sometimes in Russian, sometimes. So if it's possible to dream in more than one language, I always say to myself, why can't I write fiction in more than one language? I'm not claiming that it's easy for me because I did not grow up bilingual. So English is for me an acquired language. You know, I will always have some gaps. And that's an experience only an immigrant can understand or only the foreigner can understand. Because when you're a foreigner, I mean, when you're speaking an acquired language, your mind is always faster than your tongue. You always want to say more, but you end up saying less, you know, than you want it. So there's always this gap, which is very intimidating, I mean, to be honest. But if we learn not to be intimidated by that, I think it's also very stimulating because it helps you to think more, to put more thought into it. Usually when we speak, we don't think that much. But because of that gap between the mind and the tongue, it spiritually and intellectually encourages us, you know, to think twice, to look at the language more closely. So I love that exercise. I like doing that. English for me is a very mathematical language. Most probably for the native speakers, it isn't like that. But for me, as a foreigner, it's very mathematical. It's the language of precision. If you're looking for the precise word, you have that word. You know, it's already out there. All you need to do is just learn it, just take it. So it has an amazing vocabulary, which I love. You know, I like the English vocabulary very much. On the other hand, I love the Turkish language. And for me, it's a very emotional language. You know, it's not as mathematical as English. It's because it's the language of my grandmother. It's the language of my childhood, right? So I feel to each and every language, I feel connected to each language in a different way. And what I like most is commuting back and forth between the two languages. As coming back to the question you asked, I never had that feeling, you know, I should have said this in Turkish or I could have said this better in Turkish, because when I'm writing in English, usually I enter into that language as if it was a continent, as if it was a space. I do not experience language as if it was an instrument that I use and then set aside. You know, it's not like a fork or a pen or a spoon that I use and then leave aside. Instead of that, it's like a place I enter into. And when you enter into that space, you don't think about the other space you left behind. So when I'm writing in English, I think in English. I inhale the language. When I'm writing in Turkish, I think in Turkish. I don't make translations, you know, in my mind, because that's very frustrating. But basically, I mean, why I'm writing in two languages is because I enjoy it. And if you're the kind of person who enjoys language, it's really, I think, very stimulating. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for being here. I really enjoyed the introduction that you read, and I found it interesting because I think in the U.S. we have this conception that love is all those things you mentioned. It is understanding, it is compassion, it is affection. And in the book, it seems like you're making a distinction between that kind of familiarity and, mm-hmm. and love. And I wonder if you could speak about how you define love in the book, and also how you specifically define the love between Rumi and Shams, because I know there's some controversy about what kind of love they shared in that relationship?
Yes, yes. Thank you. I appreciate the question. Actually, it's a tough question. You know, how do I define love? Because it is so difficult to define love, and yet we can't just abandon the endeavor. We have to go on trying to define and redefine. And I think love doesn't... Maybe it's not a stage. Maybe it's multiple stages when you fall in love, but then there's more. There's another season. After each season, there's another season. I see it as a constant, perhaps a continuous journey. But basically what I was interested in is this: in the Sufi philosophy, love is not about our egos. Usually what we do is we always talk about, We put ourselves in the front, right? We say, it's my husband, my wife, my love, as if that person is our possession. So there's too much emphasis on the me, me, me part. Whereas in the love that Rumi talks about, there's no ego. As a matter of fact, as the ego diminishes, love becomes more robust. So there's, you know, you see the relation between the two. That said, I wasn't interested in the controversy. Because for me, the bond between Rumi and Shams of Tabriz is a spiritual bond. That's how I chose to perceive it. That's how I chose to reflect it. So I think they were companions on the road, and this is the path of love, and they were very good companions, you know, travelers on that road. That's how I perceived it. I have to say, I mean, They were, as I said, so very different. They transformed each other so much. And when you look at Sufi philosophy, in the teachings, there's a lot of emphasis on that. I mean, to find the person who will reflect, who will be your mirror, who will be the mirror of your spirit. So in my opinion, it's better to discuss it on a more spiritual level. However, in my book, I didn't take mundane love and spiritual love as mutually exclusive things. I wanted to connect all of them together because I think the essence is the same. You know, if we want to go to the essence, if we want to go deeper into the essence is universal and it's one and the same. My connection with Sufism started like 15, 16 years ago when I was a student at college. I don't know if I may say I studied it, but I started reading on the subject, and the more I read, the more interested I became. At the beginning, it was a more, I should say, an intellectual curiosity, but over in time, it became more emotional. You know, I felt a connection in my heart, not only in my brain, not only in my mind. But I think every day I'm learning something new. And when you're interested in Sufism, knowledge is important, but sometimes knowledge is a barrier.
My question was, lately in Turkey, Sufism all of a sudden became fashion. Mm-hmm. There are books coming out, even from politicians. Mm-hmm. Is it coincidence that your book on Sufist love mm-hmm. It came out about the same time frame.
Thank you. I think it's an important question. Not only in Turkey, I mean all around the world, there is a lot of interest, in, especially in Rumi, but also in Sufi philosophy in general. Now, I have to be frank. I mean, we writers, we like to think that we are very different. We like to think that we are ahead of our time, that we're very unusual creatures, like we have nothing to do with the society, nothing with, you know, to do with the times we're living. But that's not true. I mean, we are the children of our cultures. We are the children of the period in which we're living. Certainly, I mean, the things I hear, I feel, I see, I observe, they do have an impact on me, certainly. But that said, I should also explain that I have had this personal journey with Sufism and within Sufism for the last 15 years. And perhaps those of you who read Turkish, who read my work in Turkish, will be familiar with this. My first novel was also a very closely, you know, heavily Sufi novel, in a different way. But Sufism is a culture, it's a philosophy that has that I try to learn more about. For a long time. So it's not a new interest, but it could have been a new interest. I mean, I wouldn't be embarrassed to say that, but in my case, it's not a new interest. However, in Turkey, there have been some criticisms saying that because the book has been a big bestseller, a major bestseller there, some critics have said that I popularized Sufism. Now, I want to think more closely about that. What does it mean to popularize? You know, if something is popular, if let's say thousands and thousands of people read the same book, does that automatically mean that that book, you know, is doing something bad? I'm not sure about that automatic connection. My point is, I think there's a charm in Rumi or in Sufi philosophy, or in mysticism. I don't know. The words, the names can change. Some people feel that connection. Some people feel that charm. And they don't know why. I don't know why. Because at the time, I was a leftist, feminist, nihilist, anarcho-pacifist. I had nothing to do with Sufism. I wasn't interested in religion at all. And when I look at my background, when I look at my family connections, there were no Sufis there whatsoever. You know, just the opposite. But I felt intrigued. Intellectually, I was interested in the subject. And the more I read, the more I wanted to read. So to me, what opened the door to Sufism, the gate to Sufism, was books. Perhaps in my case, it was very natural that it was like that, because I always loved reading books. And that's how I felt connected to many things in my life. But I have met other people in whose case the door was music. You know, they heard the sound of the ney, the reed flute, for the first time, and they felt something in their heart, and they took another step, another step. So for each and every person, the door might be different. Maybe when you open that door, you won't go towards Rumi, you will go towards someone else. But that doesn't matter. I think the essence is the same. There is a spiritual quest. We want to know, you know, about death, about life, what we're doing in this world, what does it mean to be human, right? What does it mean, you know, to die tomorrow? So we want to put more meaning into all these questions, we each and every one of us, and especially in this age. I think spirituality and religiosity are different things. They're not exactly the same thing. And more people are talking about this. So you might be right. It might be, you know, maybe it's not a coincidence that in this age many people are being interested in that, but there's also a personal journey behind my writing this book.
What made you choose the contemporary family to be Jewish and from Boston?
Thank you. You know, as a few minutes ago we were talking about connections, I wanted to write about this women character in such a way that, let's say, when a woman reader reads about her in Istanbul or Izmir, even though she has never been in America, even though she never had a Jewish, you know, friend, she could feel this woman. I wanted to I very much believe in that, because I think literature should bring us together, should not divide us into categories. So although I use these different identities all the time, my ultimate aim is to melt those identities to the point that I can bring people together through my arts and perhaps make fiction a bridge between different people. I think empathy is a very central word for us writers, to learn to empathize with other people. I mean, those people might be very, very different, but precisely because of that, to learn to empathize. The woman character is a Jewish American. The male character is actually a Scottish man converted to Islam. You know, in each and every one of my novels, I like to write about minorities. And when I say minorities, it's not necessarily an ethnic minority or a religious minority. I like to write about people who feel lonely, you know, who feel a little bit on the fringes of the society for this reason or that reason. I like to give them more voice and to listen to their stories. So there's a lot of that in my books. But basically what I like to do is to create connections, both between my characters, I mean between different characters, but also the readers and the characters, readers from very different backgrounds and characters from very different backgrounds.
Hello. My question is about your first novel, Pinhan. I guess the English title is The Sufi. So although the characters, like although Dervish Pinhan and Shams looked like two opposite characters, when I was reading the novels, I felt a connection and I even felt a similarness between Pinhan and Shams. Mm. So my question is, when you were writing the For the Rules of Love after almost 10 years after Pinhan,
more
I guess.
More than that, yeah.
Yeah. Did you feel a connection between those two characters, and what kind of a connection
you think? Thank you. That book has not been translated into English, and as a matter of fact, I think of all the books that I've written so far, it is the one that is most difficult to translate into any other language, because the language was so esoteric. It was my first novel, and I don't know if the Sufis would be the right way to translate the title, although, you know, that's what it says in many biographies. Perhaps we can say the hidden, you know, Pinhan as the word also means the hidden. So the text itself is also is a little bit hidden in many ways. But when I was writing the 40 Rules of Love, I did not look back, and I never do that, as a matter of fact, you know, because when I put all my books side by side, one thing surprises me. Each and every one of them is so different in its energy, in its style, because I've changed so much. When I write a book, it changes me. You know, before I start writing The 40 Rules of Love, I'm a different person. As I keep writing it, it changes me, it affects me. I think there are two different ways of writing a novel, of being a novelist. The first path is you're like an engineer, and you know what you're going to write. You have designed everything precisely in your mind, and all you need to do is just sit down, you know, spend some time with it, and put everything on paper. I have a lot of respect for this style of writing, and there have been very good examples of this. However, this is not my style. I don't feel it close to my heart. What I feel close to my heart is the second path, in which you write with intuition. And usually when you start the first page, you don't quite know where you're going to. You know, you have some characters, but you don't know how they're going to end up. You don't know what's going to happen to that character, you know, 8 pages later or 10 pages later. So the book or the story is full of surprises for the writer herself as well, not only for the reader. I like to be surprised when I'm writing. So I don't feel like a puppeteer. You know, I don't feel like I'm above the text, above the characters, or above the readers, and I'm controlling the thing. I don't even think it belongs to me. And I honestly, this was one of the major dilemmas I felt when I was writing this, because on the one hand, we writers, we have huge egos, we have inflated egos, especially novelists, because in every other, you know, art, people learn to do teamwork. Like when you look at a film director, a director knows how to work with other people. Right? A musician knows how to work with other people. But the novel is not like that. It is the loneliest form of art. That's what Walter Benjamin says. You think you're God. You think you create characters. You think you kill those characters. For weeks and months, you're on your own and creating something basically alone. So as novelists, we end up having really inflated, huge, huge egos. So on the one hand, I have that ego. But on the other hand, I look at Rumi, a poet who has written so many amazing, you know, poems, but he never calls himself a poet. He sees himself as an instrument. He thinks creativity is coming to him from a bigger source, and he also is, he's only the channel in which those words are channelized and they reach to other people. So he doesn't think he's the owner of his words. And I have that in me too, so I have this contradiction inside. But I'm sorry, it was a long answer. Thank you.
I want to first thank you for putting a glossary in there because it's amazing to me how some authors don't do that when they are using words that are not familiar in English book is English. So that aside, I was fascinated with the structure, and I found it compelling, the short chapters that pushed you through, to want to get to the next chapter. And so I'm wondering if, you know, when you say that you have your characters and you start with that and you're not sure where they're going.
Right.
So I have two questions. Right. One, how did you come to the structure of this book? It's the only book of yours I've read, so I don't know if it's even remotely similar to your other books in structure. And also, since you say you let the characters take you where they're going, we did know where Shams and Rumi's relationship was going to end up. I mean, what was going to happen because it was foreshadowed in the beginning. We didn't know that with Ella and Aziz. So did you know what was going to happen to them in the beginning? Or did it just come upon you as you were writing?
Oh, that's such a good question. Thank you. No, I didn't know, you know, how the story would end. I mean, I had a feeling. Usually that's what happens. I start with a picture, with an image in my mind. Sometimes it's very visual. It's only a scene. Or sometimes I only have a feeling. Or only the colors. You know, I can see the shades, the colors, the hues, but that's about it. And after that, you need to take a step, another step, and follow your intuition and follow the characters and let them create themselves. There have been times in some of my previous books, let's say in The Saint of Incipient Insanities, there's an American character, a bisexual, suicidal, chocolate maker, intellectual woman, very colorful. But honestly, when I started the novel, I thought she would be a side character, you know? But I loved her so much as I kept writing, and she became more and more powerful. So in the end, I ended up making her one of the central characters in the book. So it happens, and I like that, you know, when the character leads me, not me owning that character. How did I decide about the structure of the novel? That was your other question. I think I wanted to, in some ways, I wanted to keep the language very simple and very, you know, modest. That modesty was very important to me as I was writing this novel. And I wanted each and every character to speak. You know, the first-person narrator was important to me. It was a big question mark, too, because on the one hand, I have a lot of respect for both Shams of Tabriz and Rumi. I didn't want to offend their spirits when I was writing this novel. But on the other hand, I'm a novelist, and I don't believe in heroes. And in none of my books there are heroes. I think, as human beings, each and every one of us, we're full of conflicts. Like a person who seems to be very nice, even the nicest person in this room, has a speck of evil inside, right? Even the person who seems very bad has a degree of goodness in him. And that's how we are. We're full of conflicts. So I wanted to tell their story as individual, as human beings, not as, you know, statues. That I didn't want to put them on a pedestal. It was very important to me to feel them as human beings and to also be able to write about their conflicts, like every one of us. And for me to be able to do that, not only with them, but with every character, I have to impersonate that character when I'm writing. So in the book, there's a, like a beggar, there's a prostitute, you know, there are all sorts of, there's a drunk, you know, a man who's, you know, keeps drinking all the time. There's the good, there's the bad. But as I was writing each section, I tried to be that person, to feel that person. And there's only one way to do that, to stop being myself. You know, I have to forget about Elif, right? I have to try to surpass the limits of the self that has been given to me by birth and try to feel that person. That's why I chose this structure. Okay. One more question. Okay, we have one more question.
It was fascinating tonight when you started to read from your book.
Thank you.
Your voice took on a different tone. It's hard to explain. It became somewhat poetic in the way you spoke. And I was wondering if I would love it if you could speak a little bit, perhaps read a paragraph in Turkish.
Oh. I wish I had a Turkish coffee with me.
Then that's...
Oh, you have...
Well, I thought there might be other people here tonight who would like that, too.
There you go. But, you know, I so much believe in that. Maybe this is something you experience as well. As we move from one language to another, I think our voices change, you know, because we don't command language. I mean, language shapes us. Well, I have to tell you a little story about the book jacket. This is a book jacket of the Turkish version. And I must confess, I'm not a person who was very fond of the color pink. But after becoming a mother, my daughter taught me, you know, to love this color because everything is pink. So I learned to, you know, I made peace with this color. And then when my publisher wanted to make the book jacket pink, I said, okay, there you go. And I surrendered. But what happened is, and this, by the way, it looks like a heart, but in fact, it's a leaf. And it is an X-ray. Of a real leaf. So if we take a closer look at the nature, you know, it's full of hearts, actually, with veins inside. So anyhow, when the book came out, I started getting all these emails, letters from male readers protesting me, you know, complaining. Really, it's true, and saying that they can't read the book because it's so pink and they cannot... And they cannot carry it. You know, they bought the book, they can read it in their house, but when they have to go on a ferry boat or a public bus, they cover it. So, and for months and months, this kept going on and on. So in the end, we prepared another version for those people who were not very comfortable. But I didn't want to make that blue, you know, in order to repeat the gender codes. So we ended up making it smoky gray, you know, really serious looking, you know, hard literature. And then they were very happy and they bought that copy. But the pink is also out there, so we didn't give up the pink one. Okay, just one paragraph. Yeah? And I can't choose now. All right. I'm not going to think. Okay. 8 sene önce Mevlana'nın evine varışımın hikayesi işte böyle. İlme aç, içine kapanık, çekingen bir çocuktum buraya geldiğimde. Ama yeni aileme çabuk ısındım. Zamanla Kerra kendi anamdan ileri oldu. Her zaman müşfik ve sevecendi. Mevlana'nın oğulları bana kucak açtı. Özellikle büyük oğlu bana gerçek bir ağabey oldu. Alaaddin beni başka türlü sever. Hiçbir şey demese de bunu hissedebiliyorum. Ama ben ona sadece bir ağabey gözüyle bakıyorum. I appreciate
it. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information is available at freelibrary.org.